good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That musical opening tonight was something a little bit new for you. I just teased you with, maybe I'll play the whole thing at the end of the show if we have time. It's called Sabbath Nights by Witch's Mark. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate. I'm the author of two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and what I like to think of as its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. I invite you to check out my website at KarenTate.com and learn more about my book, my tours, workshops, and our Sacred Sunday services, which happen to be this Sunday. While you're there, please take advantage of the free downloadable meditations. They're my gift to you, my listeners, advocates of Goddess. Tonight's my great pleasure to have two very interesting and wonderful guests adding their wisdom and dedication to the treasure trove that is the archives here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. The first is Professor Greg Garrett, and he's going to be talking about his most recent book, One Fine Potion, The Literary Magic of Harry Potter and What Spirituality We Find in the Beloved Series of J.K. Rowling. After that, after that chat, filmmaker Emmanuel Etier will be with us talking about the film he's making, which is in post-production, called Femme. I know you're going to want to hear about that. We have been waiting for something like that for way too long. And if you stay with me till the end, I have some funny stuff for you. The Chronicles of Baobo Biggins, Episode 3, Misogyny on Parade. This is a column I hope to share with you as regularly as they're written. And for those of you versed in goddess spirituality or women's studies, I think the name Baobo Biggins might give you a chuckle. And from Jane, she sent me an email of these incredibly funny bumper stickers I'm sure you'll all wish you had to display in this politically volatile time. So stay with me. And just a few announcements. I am really excited about the new addition to my show. It started in January, and it's once a month. The first week of the month, which is next week, I'm going to be doing sacred salons with you, or as some of you call it, ritual on the radio. What I'm trying to do is inspire insight into goddess-inspired living and create and share sacred space together with you on the airwaves. And I hope you'll listen and send me your feedback. Next week, we're going to, as our topic, we're going to be having a sacred salon themed The Greening of the Earth. And don't forget our monthly Sacred Sundays at the Green Man Store in North Hollywood on Lancashire. Our next service for women and men is this Sunday, as I mentioned before. And our theme Sunday is also Greening of the Earth. And we'll also be paying tribute to Isis, whose sacred festival was held around the first week in March in antiquity. So please come, introduce yourself, let me know if you're a listener. And for more info on any of that, you can email me at KarenTate108@ca.org. And remember, catch any show from the archives. You can also listen via iTunes as well. And if you can't tune in live but have questions, you can always email me your questions several days before the show. I'll do my best to ask our guests. And I want to thank you for your input and feedback and everything you, my listeners, contribute to the show. Your comments are always welcome. You are gas in my tank. So stay tuned. Call in if you like. And that number is 718-766-4662. But without further delay, let me tell you a little bit about Greg Garrett before we start our interview discussing the spiritual wisdom of Harry Potter. Greg is one of America's leading voices on religion, culture, and politics, a novelist and memoirist. He is probably best known as the author of nonfiction works, including The Gospel According to Hollywood. That might be something interesting we could talk about as well on another show. He also has written We Get to Carry Each Other, The Gospel According to You Two, One Fine Potion, The Literary Magic of Harry Potter, which we're talking about tonight, and The Other Jesus. There's another interesting topic. Greg writes on religion, culture, politics, and narrative narrative for the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, Christianity Today, and in his weekly column, Faithful Citizenship at Patheos.com. He's discussed his work or seen it covered in media, including the New York Times, the New Yorker, National Review, USA Today, Headline News, CBS Radio, BBC Radio, National Public Radio, and the Bob Edwards Show. Prolific he is. Greg teaches creative writing, literature, film, and theology at Baylor University, where he has twice won university-wide teaching awards. He also serves as writer-in-residence at the Episcopal Theological Seminary of the Southwest and spends part of each year as a residential scholar at the Gladstone Library in Wales, Lutwyge, the UK's only prime ministerial library. When he isn't on the road speaking, preaching, or writing, Greg lives in Austin with his beautifully complicated family. I went to Facebook, Greg, and saw some pictures there. Nice.
Of my beautifully complicated family.
So, Greg, I guess as much as, you know, maybe we should have you back to talk about some of those other books, The Other Jesus and The Gospel According to Hollywood. I think we could have some fun with that, too. But
yeah.
For tonight, you know, let's focus on the Harry Potter series. As I explained to you before we went live, I don't know a whole lot about Harry Potter. I didn't read the books. I saw a couple of the movies. So you're going to have to, you know, help me a little bit there. But I wonder first, what first grabbed you to start to delve into this and find not just the magic that so many people, especially, you know, Christian people in some corners seem to hate about the movie, but, you know, what spirituality did you find in addition to the magic?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, as part of my beautifully complicated family, I have a 14-year-old boy, Chandler, and Chandler has grown up reading the Harry Potter novels. And so he read the first couple of those, and he kept saying, "Dad, you've got to read these. These are amazing." And because of the kind of work that I do with narrative and religion and culture, other people were kind of pointing out to me that there are some really interesting things going on in these books and then later in the movies. And as I sometimes do, I just sort of hold out for a little while and go, no, I'm not going to, everybody's reading this. It's like, I'm not going to pay attention to this. It's a ridiculous sort of elitism that I have that goes back to high school, I think. It's like, no, I'm not going to listen to that band. I'm listening to these bands. But when I first started reading along behind Chandler and watching the movies with him as they came out, it became clear to me that there was this really powerful spiritual message that was being spread in these books that's very countercultural, about the importance of community as opposed to the power of the individual, which is sort of what we exalt in our culture, about heroism and doing the right thing at all costs, which is, again, something that we don't typically do. And this really powerful example of heroism instead of celebrity, because one of the things that we know about Harry from the very beginning of the series is that he's one of the most famous people in his community, the wizarding community, and he could have been one of those people who could have gotten by on his celebrity for his entire life, you know, sort of a Paris Hilton of the magic-using community. But instead of it being sort of it's all about me, he really does buy into this, I think, really powerful spiritual ethic, which is that, I'm going to put other people first and serve them and love and sort of live this life of self-sacrifice, which is at the heart of, you know, sort of what we understand about powerful spiritual tradition.
Well, and let me just sort of comment on that a little bit. I think I call myself a goddess advocate. I'm a recovering Catholic, so you know, so I spent most of my life, you know, in New Orleans, in the Bible Belt,
right.
You know, doing the Catholic thing. Though quite honestly, you know, it was one of those things I didn't choose. I was sort of born into it, and you know, my family wasn't fanatical about it. And then I move out to California, and I discover with you know the goddess that's been swept beneath the rug, and the divine feminine, and all of this. And so that sort of, you know, added to my spiritual psyche, so to speak. And of late, you know, you started to talk about individualism. And of late, we see so much on television that the religious right, you know, that you know, they bow at the altar of Ayn Rand. You know, it's all about individualism, which seems so counter to Jesus. You know, and it's interesting, I guess, hearing you talk about that, because And I'm wondering what was going on in Christian communities. Was this the message that Christians were getting from, you know, the Harry Potter series? You know, the sharing, the sacrifice, the partnership, which is an ideal of goddess spirituality, partnership, and negotiation, egalitarianism, that sort of stuff. I guess I'm wondering how did that all settle out, you know, in the Christian community? Was it progressives versus conservatives, you know, kind of a thing? I'm just curious.
Well, you know, when you ask that sort of question, there's no easy answer to it, because people will ask me sometimes, what do Christians think about this? And all I can say is, this is what I think about this. And, you know, there are people in my family who would think differently and people in my faith community who might think differently. But the two major reactions we have to Harry Potter are the two that you sort of outlined so far tonight, which one of them is the sort of Harry Potter as satanic that I'll talk about just a second. And then the other would be Harry Potter as a sort of retelling of the gospel narratives. And one of the things that I've said in media interviews is that I really do think of Harry Potter as a 4,100-page retelling of the gospel narrative. And in literary terms, if I could be an English professor for a second, Harry is definitely what we call a Christ figure, which is not to say that he is Jesus, but that he has these characteristics of the character of Jesus, somebody who is self-sacrificing and willing to give his life for those he loves in the hope of creating a better and more inclusive world. And so we've got those two things. The satanic thing is still out there, even though J.K. Rowling has self-identified as a member of the Church of Scotland. And as she has said in interviews going all the way back to the beginning, you know, she's not interested in Satan. She's not interested in magic per se, except as a sort of literary device in a fantasy tale. But there are still, you know, of course, people who read the Bible in a very literal way. And in fact, it's not just Christian fundamentalists. It's also Jewish fundamentalists and Muslim fundamentalists and Hindu fundamentalists who have come out against the Harry Potter stories. And I consider this sort of a badge of honor. When the last Harry Potter novel came out, there was actually a bookstore in the Middle East that was it was threatened by a terrorist bombing if they went ahead with the book opening. So it sort of seems like there are you know, sort of repressives across the board who don't like this story for one reason or another.
Well, do you think they didn't like it because, you know, so-called witches and, I don't know, were the guys considered witches or warlocks? I don't know what term they used in the book. I know there's the muggles, but that's the normal people. so, you know, were they the people that thought this was so horrible? Was it because, you know, they're still living by these old, antiquated, misinformed notion of what Wicca and witchcraft really is?
Yeah, I think there's this very strong sense that these are people who are reading, you know, the Hebrew Bible literally and looking at Leviticus and Leviticus where it talks about not suffering a witch to live. And, you know, this is not a, you know, in my Christian understanding, this is not an authoritative text. You know, it's sort of belly up against those things that say that you're not supposed to eat catfish or shellfish. You know, you would not have been happy in New Orleans trying to live by these guidelines. They are, you know, very sort of restrictive guidelines issued to a particular people at a particular moment in history. And I think a lot of times when people try and read the Bible as a sort of cookbook, they're ignoring the fact that a lot of times these, you know, moral prescriptions are given to particular people at a particular time. And so I think there's this very definite sense in which people are reading their sacred texts very badly. And, you know, if they were going to read it literally, it should say something like, thou shalt not have witches in a British fantasy tale. I mean, that would be, I think, the only place where we could find it to be authoritative.
Well, Aaron, I'm going to ask this in a different way. And if you still you know, feel like there's not really an answer you're comfortable with, that's okay. So as you're out there in the world, not your personal opinion, but within your colleagues in academia, I don't know, within whoever you had contact with, where a discussion of Harry Potter came about, maybe your students, for instance, or people you interviewed, or people, articles you've read on the internet. Do you think this idea, Harry's, persona, you called him like a sort of like a Christ figure, the self-sacrificing, the guy who's in service. Do you think that came across? And if it did come across, did it say, did anybody notice it stood in stark contrast to the, the individualism stuff of, the Ayn Rand Christian crowd?
Oh, nice. I think there's been a very real understanding of that among people who have grown up with these stories. I've talked with a lot of kids and a lot of parents, and when the kids have grown up with this as kind of a formative moral story, it's kind of the heart of their development, there has been this very real sense that they are standing in stark opposition to the it's all about me ethos that's so much a part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite stories that grows out of the Harry Potter communities, and there have been really interesting and powerful communities that have formed around this, but there have been people who have gotten together to do philanthropy. And all they had in common was that they had read these books, and they had this sort of, to sort of use the evangelical Christian trope, instead of what would Jesus do, they were asking themselves, what would Harry do?
okay.
We don't have necessarily the power to, to do these particular spells, but we have resources, and we have our own kind of collective power when we get together. And there have been people who have gotten together simply because they've read these books, and they've done these incredible things. They've gotten money together to drill water wells for villages in Africa without potable water. They've banded together to get people out of sexual slavery. Just this sort of amazing ethos that's grown out of what in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire is sort of referred to as this doing what is right instead of what is easy, which is kind of the ethos of the whole series boiled down to a few words.
Interesting. That's what they say in Kabbalah, too. Do what's right, not what's easy. Do the uncomfortable things. That's how you get the light.
Nice.
I was reading some of your articles, and you said the novels not only entertain but teach deeply held truths about ourselves, others, and the world around us. Is that something else besides what we've just been talking about?
It's something that mostly happens unbeknownst to us. Rowan Williams, who's the Archbishop of Canterbury and maybe the greatest English language theologian alive, was the person that I dedicated my book to. He's a friend of mine and an amazing reader. And in one of his theological treatises, he wrote, "All good stories change us if we hear them attentively." And the idea is that if we read something which espouses these values, it's what I call in some of my other writing a sort of I am third ethos. The sacred is first, my friends and neighbors are second, and I am third. Instead of that American ethos, it's all about me, the Ayn Rand, I'm going to grab what I can, don't try and regulate me or I'll walk all over you,
Mm-hmm.
But if we read or if we watch or if we listen, I think music can also be part of these things that change us radically. What we feed our souls with, I think really matters. And, I often talk about how it's important to feed our souls with things that, sort of create these good values in us. It's one of the reasons that I really feel strongly that this is an amazing series for children and for adults, because it helps, if we pay attention to what's going on in these stories, to turn us into the kinds of spiritual people that we're talking about, that are willing to live in loving self-sacrifice.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, how conflicted a child must be growing up loving, you know, reading Harry Potter, loving Harry Potter and the characters, if they live in a community that has more of the Ayn Rand mentality. You know, they must really feel, I don't know, confused.
Yeah, I think there's got to be some of that. I spoke at Chapel at Baylor about 3 weeks ago, and Baylor is a place that I've taught for 20 years, and it's a great school. You know, the ethos there is largely conservative, and so many of the students there, probably half of them, come from very conservative Christian homes. But when I asked people in that chapel, and this was basically the entire freshman class, about 3,000, 4,000 people, how many of them had read Harry Potter or had seen the films, almost everyone in that auditorium had been, at one time or another, been exposed to these things. And I'm a big believer that good ideas can out-wrestle bad ideas. And that's certainly my hope, you know, that if we put J.K. Rowling and Ayn Rand in a closed room together in one of those cage matches.
Ayn Rand would come out bloody.
Self-sacrificial ethos of love is gonna beat the spirituality of greed, you know, like 9 times out of 10.
Well, I sure hope so. Well, so did you think the novels did anything to sort of help dispel misinformation about, say, you know, earth-based spirituality or you know, the world of nature or anything like that?
You know, probably not. They are mostly, you know, they're mostly fantasy novels with, you know, kind of 1 foot in reality, but not really enough of a foot in reality for it to be particularly topical about much of anything. The only topical stuff that I think that really gets addressed is there's some political stuff that grows out of the War on Terror. There are, I think, in like the 5th and 6th and 7th novels and the corresponding films, some things that sort of draw attention to some of the excesses of the Bush administration and the Blair administration in terms of things like torture and rendition. But there is very little, honestly, about tangible spirituality in the books. It's mostly acted out in terms of the ethos of the characters.
Okay. Well, and you say that magic is at best a side theme of the Potter story. Not having read the books, that was kind of surprising to me.
Yeah, in a sense, you know, you could turn Harry Potter into a science fiction epic, and you could trade magic wands for ray guns and brooms for, I don't know, teleportation. In some ways, the magic is a story element more than it is a spiritual element. You know, what people do in terms of magic, it doesn't have much to do with faith and belief. It has largely to do with knowledge. And so it's like a body of knowledge that these people master as opposed to a spiritual understanding that they have about the world around them. And there's not much of a, I don't know, any sort of spiritual or theological grounding for how magic exists in J.K. Rowling's universe. It just does, and certain people can use it, and the rest can't. So it is largely a story element of fantasy literature. And, you know, I would like to think that it expands some tolerance for Wiccans, but if it does, I think it's probably a side element. It's probably not something that J.K. Rowling ever set out to do.
Well, and I would have to think, though, just like, say, the, what was it, Charmed on television, you know, that put the three female witches in a rather positive light. I would have to think that.
Yeah, they were hot.
Yeah. You know, I would at least have to think that if you grew up, you know, hearing the, you know, don't suffer a witch to live, then you see Harry Potter, then you'd have to kind of scratch your head and go, huh?
Yeah, because, like, I love Hermione. I love Luna Lovegood. I love Professor McGonagall. These are good people. And
mm-hmm.
The fact that they use magic, you know, it's clear that these are not sinful people or bad people. They're heroic people and loving people. So I think, yeah, you're right in that respect, that it's going to be really hard for people to at least not have cognitive dissonance when they try and put those things in the same room. And probably it's going to be, you know, this just simply is not an issue for me.
So when the religious fundamentalists went to censor the books, I think you felt that was misguided, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, it's tremendously ironic because from the very beginning, J.K. Rowling identified herself as a person of faith. And she actually talked about, even as early as the first book, the idea that it was growing in some way out of her faith tradition. And, you know, we were talking about Harry being a Christ figure. We don't really see how much that takes place until the seventh novel, when he reaches this point where he has to decide whether he is willing to sacrifice himself for his world. But she had told people all the way back to the beginning, you know, I'm not a Satanist, and I'm not here to draw people to a particular way of thinking or way of life. I'm just trying to tell the story, the most powerful story that I can. And so there's this incredible irony that in some ways she has told this story so well that people around the world have been exposed to some of the core spiritual beliefs that she has in ways they might never have been exposed to otherwise. So it's a really powerful vehicle for spiritual meaning.
So do you think when the religious fundamentalists went to censor it, they either didn't know or were totally ignoring the heroism, the sacrifice? I mean, were they blinded by the idea that these, you know, these people were practicing magic?
Well, most of them had not read it. And that's often the case with censors. It's like, you know, well, I'm not going to watch this or I'm not going to listen to this because I know that it's bad for me. But often they would quote one line from the first book, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, the Philosopher's Stone, in the rest of the world. And toward the end of the book, there is a line, and one of the characters says something about there not being any good or evil, there is only power. And I saw that in so many articles and so many blog posts, and so many of these viral emails. And it comes back to this whole question of really bad reading. A lot of times fundamentalists, whether they're Jews or Christians or Muslims, do what in seminary we called proof texting, which is finding one tiny portion of a text that agrees with what you already think and using that to represent the entire thing. And that particular line is in that Harry Potter novel, it's also in that first film, but it's spoken by the villain. And there is not a line in the entire book which is more opposite to the actual meaning of the text. It's very clear from all of the Harry Potter stories that there is such a thing as good and evil. And this whole pragmatic idea of power and the exercise of power is the thing that is represented by the villain, Lord Voldemort. It's just a really bad example of bad reading.
Okay.
And so these were people who hadn't read or who had read incredibly selectively or had had a tiny bit of experience where somebody had said to them, hey, have you heard that this is in that book? And so that added on to the, you know, those biblical proscriptions that were making them nervous already, I think made them feel like this was a book that couldn't possibly have any spiritual value, and they could not have been more wrong.
So you say that you think the series concludes with a powerful spiritual message of hope for the future. Speak a little bit about that.
Okay, I absolutely will. In a lot of spiritual traditions, there is, you know, some question about what's going to happen to us next, and that's one of the things that religion is always interested in. And the seventh book of Harry Potter, the one where Harry sort of steps into his destiny, is one that is in, you know, it's about the end of the world. And the end of the world is always interesting to us. We've got the Mayan end of the world coming this year, apparently. The rapture was predicted for last year. We had that wonderful 2000, millennium bug that we were so nervous about. And in Deathly Hallows, which is the seventh book, the seventh and eighth films, we get what looks like the end of the world. It looks like evil is going to triumph. It looks like greed and power are going to run sort of roughshod over existence. And it's what in literary terms we would think of as an apocalyptic story. It's something about the end of the world and about this sort of moment when we're coming up against what looks like the end of everything that's worth having. But there's this very powerful action that Harry takes, and for those who haven't yet seen the final film or read the final book, I will leave it a little bit open. But the action that Harry takes in the final book changes everything. And it's something that we often find in apocalyptic literature, this idea that either God is going to move, spirit is going to move, that some kind of powerful change is going to take place that's going to lead to what we would consider a happy ending. And what we can say is that Harry's choice changes everything, and it sort of ushers a new world into being. And after 4,100 pages, the last sentence of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows is, I think, one of the most beautiful statements of hope we find in any literature. It's the very simple three-word sentence, "All was well." And that is our hope, and it's one of the things that we rely on our spiritual traditions, our wisdom traditions, to help us kind of live into, is this idea that whatever chaos and evil and darkness that we encounter in the world, that we have this hope that through our own actions, through the actions of people that are in journey with us, through love, through self-sacrifice, that there is this possibility that evil and death can be overthrown in some way. And of course, it's a very powerful message in my Christian tradition, but it's a powerful spiritual message, however you think of it. The idea that through this power of love, which really is at the core of the Harry Potter novels, that someday all will be well.
Well, and you also say that the series sort of spoke to the power of community to form and shape us. What do you mean by that?
Well, we've been talking about Ayn Rand. God love her. I read her as a teenage boy, and I think only teenage boys should read her, don't you?
That seems I don't
to
think
be about
anybody
the right
should
audience.
Read her. But anyway, I'm not about to start censoring books.
I'm just, I'm a 50-year-old man, and so I can look back on 50 years of existence, and I think probably years 14, 15, 16 were the right years for me to read Ayn Rand, and so that's what I'm going to recommend. Read it then, get it out of your system, you're already selfish, go ahead and just live into it. But there's this very powerful sense in Harry Potter, and part of it, by the way, and this is a literary thing, British novels tend to be very different from American novels, and that's our cultural history. In American history, when we look at the great American novels, they're almost always about radical individuals. And British novels, great British novels, are typically about where somebody fits into society, where they fit into their community. And so from the very beginning, we've got this idea that we've got a very different kind of hero. When I speak about Harry Potter, I often like to get up and sort of act out that kind of primal montage scene we find in American action films where the hero is, getting ready to go out and confront the bad guys, and strapping on, this weapon and that weapon, and this gun goes in the holster, and this bandera of ammunition goes over the shoulders. And we've got that kind of archetypal scene of the single hero who's going to go out to conquer evil. And then I typically ask, how long would Harry have survived without his community? And, people will shout out answers, but it's pretty clear. Harry doesn't make it through the first book without his community. Without Ron and Hermione, his best friends, without the mentor figures, Professor McGonagall, Dumbledore, the head of school, even without the villains, without Malfoy, Draco Malfoy, who's sort of his evil counterpart, there's this very clear sense that community is the place where we get formed. And in my tradition, we talk often about the African Christian tradition of Ubuntu, Desmond Tutu has written several books about Ubuntu, which is the idea that we're formed in community, that we live and love each other, and that instead of being these radical individuals who are out merely for ourselves, that we need each other to become the people that we're called to be. And so there's very powerful sense throughout the Harry Potter novels that community forms and tests and encourages and loves. We have Harry, who is a student at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, where he is a member of one of the four houses. And each of those four houses has sort of a different guiding principle, and they're in opposition to each other. He is part of this community where he and his two best friends solve all of these problems together. He belongs to Dumbledore's Army, which is a student organization that forms to fight evil, and later is a member of the Order of the Phoenix, which is this larger organization to fight Voldemort and his Death Eaters. And there's this very clear sense in the Harry Potter books that community is absolutely necessary to make us into the people we're supposed to be. And we see that in Harry's case and in the lives of the people near to him. The most dramatic example, though, is a relatively minor character named Neville Longbottom, who's in all of the novels. But the first times we see him in the first few books, he's kind of this bumbling character. And then when we see him in the seventh book at the end of the story, he has turned into a hero, and he has learned from his community, and he actually stands up to Lord Voldemort, the evil Dark Lord at the end, and is one of the people most responsible for his defeat. And I think maybe that's the most dramatic way that we can see that no matter who you are, where you are, that we really need these communities to form us into the people we're supposed to be. And that's, I think, a really strong antidote to this Ayn Rand, I'm going to get mine, you get yours kind of American mentality, which is, unfortunately so pervasive today.
Well, let me ask you, Greg, what do you think came first, the chicken or the egg, in terms of the Ayn Rand mentality? Do you think, like, for instance, Eric Cantor and all those Republican politicians who, bow at that altar, just use Ayn Rand as an excuse for being selfish, or do you think it was Ayn Rand who actually influenced them? I mean, you're speculating, of course. I mean, you can't get inside their head.
Ayn Rand always described herself as a philosopher who wrote novels. And as somebody who writes novels, I am very suspicious of that. The Ayn Rand novels are not very good novels, and that's my literary judgment. And I'm with you, I don't want to censor. But they're very compelling because they present a worldview in which people are allowed to do whatever they want. And I think that Ayn Rand offers people a justification for that kind of me-first capitalism,
mm-hmm.
which is a big part of our American psyche. I'm finishing up a book now on religion and politics, and I've been doing a ton of reading, and a lot of it, surprisingly, has been from Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, which is the great 19th century sort of sociological treatise about the American character. And what he was writing in the early 19th century was basically, Americans are usually able to put aside that me-first thing to advance the common good, but it is there at the very heart of who they are. And there was a sense that he had is that, it goes all the way back to our founding, that we came here as these sort of rugged individualists seeking our own way, whether it was in religion or capitalism or whatever. So I think in answer to your question, Ayn Rand offers us today, these people who sort of cite her as their moral touchstone, she offers people who already believe this a chance to sort of legitimize their views. But it's something that goes back probably a couple hundred years in the American psyche. And we also look at these sort of 19th century, making good in America narratives, which are about, somebody coming here and becoming a million-dollar capitalist. The Horatio Alger.
Why do you think, you were saying, British literature is different. It's more about you know, how you're fitting into society. Why do you, what do you think makes theirs, you know, steered in that direction?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, off the top of my head, I'm going to suggest that probably it has something to do with the perception of class. The British still, I think, have a perception of class that, you know, there are sort of gradations of society. In America, we have the perception that class doesn't exist, although, you know, as we look at these statistics on income inequity, it becomes very clear that you are almost certain to, you know, to be in the same sort of class your entire lifetime, that this mobility that was such a part of the American dream is, if not already disappeared, at least rapidly disappearing. So in Britain, I think they have this understanding that people occupy different economic strata, if you will, and that it has a difference in the way they live their lives, in the challenges that, you know, people in the various classes face. And here we have this sort of radical democratization where we try and pretend that we're all alike. And so we have presidential candidates who sort of pretend that they're like us, even if they make more money in 2 days than we make in an entire year.
Right, right. Okay. Well, hold on 1 second here. I want to check. Someone popped up on the switchboard, and I just want to make sure it's not someone who had a question for you, if you're okay taking questions.
Sure.
Okay. Let me unmute them. Hi, this is Karen. Did you have a question for Greg?
Just listening. Thank you.
Just listening. Okay, thank you. We'll keep hanging on. Well, Greg, I, you know, as long as we're talking about, you know, politics and religion, I'm going to have to send you a video clip of a paper I gave to the American Academy of Religion. And the premise was, as long as we're stuck with religion and politics, then we claim that Goddess is a Democrat. if she were going to choose a political party, so I'll send you that so you can maybe get a chuckle out of. But I would love to have you back at some point and talk about the other Jesus and the gospel according to Hollywood. Do you want to just give us sort of a little synopsis what those two are about?
Yeah, I would be happy to. Let me start with The Gospel According to Hollywood, because that's the earlier book. And one of the things you do if you're a writer is that you're sort of developing an idea over a period of time. And so that's an earlier book that's an attempt to kind of look at spirituality and faith through Hollywood movies. And so it's, you know, since my tradition is the Christian tradition, that's what I'm looking at largely, although it's typically going to be something that expands into other traditions as well. And the work that I do in religion and culture is basically this whole idea about Rowan Williams' statement that all good stories change us if we hear them attentively. And so even if somebody doesn't set out to write something which is religious and spiritual, often, of course, they'll have powerful messages. I mean, all of us have heard a song on the radio that got us through a hard day or, saw a movie that kind of spoke to us where we were at our lives in that moment. And that's kind of what The Gospel According to Hollywood is about. Trying to kind of quantify those powerful spiritual messages in mainstream Hollywood films from roughly the 30s to the present. And one of my PhD areas was film, and I've always loved studying film, and this was a chance to kind of bring together those interests. And then The Other Jesus was a book that kind of grew out of all of this writing I was doing on religion and culture, because I would go out and speak about U2, or I would go out and speak about film and spirituality, or about Harry Potter. And people, you know, I don't know if this is true in the goddess community, but in the Christian community, they'll sort of try and buttonhole you and say, well, what do you really think about this? And so The Other Jesus was a chance for me to kind of formulate what I thought progressive faith looked like for Christians in the 21st century. What does it mean to sort of set aside the judgment that people too often associate with Christianity? And to center my attention on what St. Augustine called the twofold commandment of love, which is love God and love your neighbors. And so The Other Jesus, I think sort of the subtitle kind of tells it all, rejecting a religion of fear for the God of love.
Okay,
and,
all right.
That's kind of a quick précis of those two projects.
Okay. Well, you know, just getting back to Harry Potter for a minute, we know that an entire generation was raised on Harry, and now, you know, the books have sort of come to an end. I mean, have you been following anything that J.K. Rowling might be planning to do post book 7? I mean, because 7 was the last one, right?
Yeah, she apparently has a couple of book projects that she is working on, and I would guess she's working on them slowly because, I mean, she is the most, well, she's the wealthiest writer in the history of history. Forbes tells us that she is the only writer ever to become a billionaire, and she is incredibly wealthy, a billionaire many times over, so she doesn't have to do anything for the rest of her life. But we know that she's very involved with charity and philanthropy, and so, you know, I'm guessing that she's still being very active in those things. And she launched a website last fall called Pottermore, which has some new content around the Harry Potter novels, and it will also be the place where finally digital copies of the Potter books are going to be available. You can't, at this point, buy an e-book of Harry Potter, but that's the place where you'll finally be able to do that and download it to your viewer or to your computer.
She's going to keep control of that, basically.
Yeah, she is. She is, and she is in a position to do that and to benefit from that, and, you know, God love her.
Okay.
Very few writers in our lifetime will have that kind of success, but it's kind of an amazing thing just to see that and to see that it is possible for somebody.
To do that, absolutely. I guess Stephen King is green with envy.
Well, you know, and he has done pretty well for himself also. but, you know, we are now at this moment where the publishing industry is changing. And like this book I'm doing on politics is the first book I'm doing is an e-book instead of a traditional, you know, book in print. But there are so many more avenues for that, and so many of the traditional publishing venues are disappearing, that it makes sense that writers actually could start taking control of their content in the same way that people in other fields have, that musicians have, that you know, some people who make films have. So it's really kind of interesting, you know, to be able to witness this. You know, we're on the cusp of, you know, a new sort of Gutenberg experience, and Rowling is like right there at the forefront of it.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that some of the people who had been reading Harry Potter were inspired to, you know, go out there and you know, do things for, you know, people in need. Do you know if Rowling ever tried to help finance any of those efforts?
You know, I think those are all grassroots things. Rowling's big things are largely around literacy. And several of the books that she's written that were not Harry Potter and books, but that were part of the Harry Potter universe, were books that she gave the proceeds to charity. And so, you know, I think that her big thing is, you know, if people, she has been very supportive of this whole idea of community forming around Harry Potter. And so all of these incredible websites and fan fiction sites, she's never sued or tried to shut down any of the fan fiction sites. I think she's saying, you know, you guys, I want you to gather around this creation of mine, but I'm going to be a little more specific in terms of my own philanthropy. And that's, I think, something that she's done so far. I can't say that she will never do that, but, you know, I, as a writer, I really like the idea of, you know, people getting together on their own and doing something because they're inspired by something I've written.
Well, and also, too, I mean, not only does it make you feel that you're helping change the world, but then, you know, you see that your work is sort of living on. You know, it's beyond just the, you know, the average book of fiction that you read and then forget about it the next week, you know?
Yeah. I was in a university this week talking about Harry Potter, and someone asked me, you know, if I thought that this was something that was going to last, and that actually has been my critical judgment. In English, we use this word called canon, C-A-N-O-N. When something enters the canon, it's being taught in high school and college classrooms. People who are becoming teachers and professors are going to go on and teach it to their kids. And when I talk about Harry Potter, I think of it as our century's Dickens. This is the most popular story of our time, but it's also one that's so much a part of our culture that I think it's going to go on being a part of our culture. I have no question that 100 years from now, people are still going to be reading Harry Potter.
Well, that's a good thing, especially considering, you know, all the wonderful messages that, you know, so obviously come through. Well, you know, you mentioned at a point in our conversation that some of the storyline you thought maybe was reflective of some stuff that was, you know, maybe going on in the Bush administration with, you know, terrorism and such. What was that storyline that might have been paralleling what was, you know, happening in the political arena?
Good. That's a great question. And I've gotten a little bit of pushback on this from people who don't like this particular interpretation, because it's a political interpretation, but it's also, I think, very much there in terms of what she's doing. J.K. Rowling says that the most important job that she had in her life was working for Amnesty International. And she talked about on a number of occasions that maybe the most important was when she gave the commencement speech at Harvard. And she talked about how important it was for people not only to do the right thing, but not to to sit back and be passive when someone else was doing the wrong thing. Because she said that's what creates monsters. That's what allows dictators to seize power. It's what allows people to torture and to do all these humanitarian crimes. And she's talked about her time at Amnesty International as the most formative in her life. And in the fifth novel, which is Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, we've got a character who's a representative of the government who comes into Hogwarts School and who begins passing all these sort of repressive, sort of what we might call anti-civil rights legislation. And then toward the end of the book, she really wants an answer from Harry. And so she decides that she's going to cast one of the three forbidden curses on him, the torture curse. And the reason she says she wants to do it is for the public good. She's like, well, you know, this is for the best. I need this information. I need this information to protect my society. And there's this very clear sense, you know, throughout that novel and in some of the others, that the government of the wizarding community is willing to do whatever it takes to remain in power. There's very much this sort of fear-based government that is willing to take any action, including these sort of unethical things. To me, it was fairly clear that she was writing this as a sort of topical post 9/11 commentary on what was in all the British papers at that time, the revelations that the British government had colluded in torture and in kidnapping of foreign nationals.
What it did anything like that happen in any of the other novels, where she had a storyline that sort of paralleled what was going on, you know, in the real world?
Yeah. In the seventh novel, Lord Voldemort has actually taken control of the government, although not all of the officials know it yet. And that same official who is willing to torture Harry is put in charge of this sort of star chamber, which is depriving people of their civil rights and deporting them and doing all of these things that sort of would be familiar to us from the sort of Guantanamo era. And there's a little bit of that in the sixth book as well, but there's this very clear sense in the last three novels that they become much more topical and a whole lot darker in their treatment of how government, you know, clings to power using these sort of unethical means.
And I'm curious, are you excited about any other, you know, up-and-coming writers or, you know, series of books that are out there or maybe about to, you know, about to be out there?
That's a great question. Chandler is reading The Hunger Games now, and he really likes those. And so I'm interested in seeing them, and I know the new movie is coming out. Twilight did not capture me at all, and I didn't really like the spiritual messages that I found in that, although it was incredibly popular. But I'm going to try out Hunger Games and see what's there, and maybe some of your listeners have some suggestions and could let us know about those.
Well, what was it about, you know, what were the messages in the Twilight series? Because they just sort of went right over my head, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, that's sort of my job, is I look for spiritual messages. You know, as an ardent feminist, I don't like anything that says that you know, what's going to make us happy in this life is that we find the right person to protect us.
Ah, okay, okay. All right, I can. Did you find any positive, you know, and any redeeming themes that that went through it?
Oh, man. Don't push me, because I really didn't like Twilight.
That's okay. That's all right. It wasn't my favorite either, but, you know, I didn't choose the team,
probably,
you know.
I would probably have to, like, sort of bite my tongue and find something. There's a lot of love. Love is always good. I guess we could say that.
Okay, okay. Well, and you know, I know we're sort of, you know, getting over into TV now, but True Blood, is that anything you've been looking at? I'm wondering if you had some thoughts on that, because it seems like to me it's pretty obvious that this anti-vampire thing sort of parallels the anti-gay thing that's going on in some parts of the world, especially since True Blood is set in the South, and it seems like, you know, it's the South that's so anti-everything.
You know, that's what I've read. I don't do a whole lot of TV. I tend to do it sort of in, I'm watching it on DVD kind of things. So right now what Jeannie and I, my partner and I, are doing is we're watching Friday Night Lights, and we will be doing that for the next few months. I did Lost for a long stretch there while I was working on a book on 9/11. And Chandler and I are watching South Park.
Oh,
that's
South
about
Park
all
is one. Have you seen the South Park episode about Mormonism yet?
Oh yes.
I think it's one of their best. It's so incredibly funny.
Yeah,
I
wrote a piece for Pathos a couple of weeks in which I referenced that, and actually took some heat from one of my readers. But I thought it was a really sort of nice thing that points out, you know, there's a lot of irrational things in any faith tradition, but Mormons are really nice people, and if this is something that turns you into really nice people, that's a pretty good thing.
I suppose I can't disagree with you there. Well, Greg, is there anything about Harry Potter that you want to make sure, you know, I mean, as far as your book examining Harry Potter or the Harry Potter series, or just in, you know, in general, you know, the literature that's out there, anything you want to tell listeners that maybe I haven't thought to ask you?
You know, I think the one thing that I would want to make sure that everybody remembers is just that Harry Potter sets up a character who is sort of the antithesis of what our culture says is important. You know, Harry is not a Charlie Sheen. He's not a Kim Kardashian. He's not a celebrity in the classic sense that, you know, he's famous because he hasn't done anything worthwhile. He is somebody who has made these hard choices to do what's right instead of what's easy, and to love others and to sacrifice for others. And there's this incredible, you know, it's a powerful spiritual message that I think travels across all of our faith and wisdom traditions, which is simply that idea of compassion, you know, that we're not here just for ourselves, we're here for others and on behalf of a community. And that's the kind of hero that I think we really want to support.
I think so, too. And I think we could use more of those types of folks in government as well. So,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
Grandma doesn't have to go live under a bridge with the Paul Ryan plan.
I would be in favor of that.
Well, Greg, thank you. Thank you so much. And, you know, I'll get back in touch with you about maybe coming back on the show, if you like, and talk about some of your other books. I really find your thinking process very interesting. I think my listeners would enjoy hearing from you again.
Thanks so much, Karen, and thanks to everybody out there, and I hope that it's a lovely evening for everyone.
Oh, wait. So important. How could we forget? If do you have a website, and how can listeners learn more about your work, your other books, and particularly get One Fine Potion, The Literary Magic of Harry Potter?
God bless you. Well, of course, our friends at Amazon are always happy to sell you books, and if you simply Google my name, Greg Garrett, and Pathos, P-A-T-H-E-O-S, it'll bring up the column that I write for them every week, and a bio for me and links to my books, and you'll have a chance to learn more than you would ever want.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. Well, we'll have a wonderful evening, and I'm gonna keep track of you now.
Great. Karen, thanks so much for having me on.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, a hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just can save the world, just will save the world. Hope you enjoyed what was a bit of a departure here, but fun nonetheless, hearing Greg's take on the spirituality, magic, and wisdom of the Harry Potter series. Well, I am waiting for our next guest to call in, Emmanuel ATA. He should be calling any moment now. He's a little bit late. So while we wait for him, I'm going to go ahead and share with you some of the stuff I was going to share at the end of the show. First, from Jane. Jane sent me these funny 2012 bumper stickers. And I'm going to share them with you. And they're for progressive thinkers. One of them says, Democrats cleaning up Republican messes since 1933. The next one says, tea parties are for little girls with imaginary friends. Then there's 2012, my president killed Osama bin Laden. How about yours? Then there's, you want to take the country back? Well, we want to move it forward. There's, he won, get over it. Then there's bipartisanship. I'll hug your elephant if you kiss my, I think you know what the last word is. Then there's teabaggers gave America a Boehner, you know, like the guy who runs the House, Boehner. Republican Boehner. Then there's voting is like driving a car. Choose R to move backwards. Choose D to move forward, as in Republican and Democrat. Then there's be proud to be everything. The right wing hates. Then there's Tea Party. White wine party is more like it, and it's not W-I-N-E, it's W-H-I-N-E, so tea party, white wine party is more like it. Then there's honk, if my taxes support your whiny tea bagging, you know, same three-letter word. Palin, 2012 to 2014 and a half, traditional values, less traditional dedication. Then there's after the rapture, can I have your car? Then there's Sarah Palin, 2012, question mark, the Mayans tried to warn us. That one's really funny. Then there's don't want government, move to Somalia. Then there's 8 years of insanity, and now you're mad? Save America, spay or neuter your Republican. Don't pray in my school, and I won't think in your church. Then there's Republicans, 2012, keeping millions out of work to put one man out of a job. Oh, that is so true. Then there's, when did Jesus become pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American? Then there's, am I liberal or just well-educated? Then there's tea, it's the new Kool-Aid. Then there's, if liberals hated America, we'd vote Republican. There's a couple more here. Democrats are sexy. Whoever heard of a nice piece of elephant? Then, annoyed by immigrants? Tell it to the Indians. Good one. And then there's, I'd vote for a Republican, but I'm allergic to nuts. And then the final one, the Republican Party, our bridge to the 11th century. So those were fun. I want to thank Jane for sending those in. And still, Emmanuel has not called yet. I think I am going to move on here and read to you the Chronicles of Baobo Biggins, Episode 3, Misogyny on Parade, as told to Katara Moon. We're going to go ahead and do that as we wait for Emmanuel to call in. I'm not sure where he is. He just emailed me today that he couldn't wait to get on the show. Anyway, here's Chronicles of Baobo Biggins. And she says, "Hello, sweeties. Balbo Biggins here. So much has transpired since we last shared Alphabet together, but I must jump right into a most wretching development on the political scene. Let me state before I start that the opinions herewith imparted are mine and mine alone. No other entity or deity should be held culpable. Usually, for health reasons, I avoid news shows. When I must peek in, it would be to Dear Rachel M. or John S. There I feel my time and energy are honored. This past week, one of Rachel Sweetie's guest hosts had a panel discussing the current bogus fight concerning women's rights versus religious freedom. Covering all bases, there was a legal representative from the Catholic Church via satellite. As I cannot remember his actual name and don't plan to look it up, I shall call him Father Bosco. Because of my own strong belief in religious freedom, I rarely share my view of the Catholic Church with others. I leave it to one's own experience to be one's guide. The panel and host were being as courteous as I would have expected of myself if I were in their socks. But, sweeties, being at home and not wearing socks, I was moved beyond restraint by the Catholic Church's rep's amazing delivery. Father Bosco opines that women are tired of the government telling them that being a woman is a medical condition which needs to be treated with contraceptives. They are tired of the government telling them that pregnancy is a disease to be terminated. I paraphrase, but only barely. It would seem that the right to express sexuality is one that Father Bosco et al. Feel qualified to define and regulate. They did such a good job in the past. You sweeties who know me can imagine my response. Father Bosco received a Balbo salute, and not in a good way. I think she means that one-finger salute. But that alone has not assuaged my dismay, and I feel compelled to share some words with the good father. And here she goes. This is from Balbo Biggins to Father Bosco in the Catholic Church. Who do you think you are to assert that you represent women, capital W? How do you, a person who lives a celibate life with some pretty nifty health care and job security, think you know the needs of women on any level? Father Sweetie, who are you, representing the Catholic Church, to think you are good stewards of born or unborn children? Your views on women should be, sheepishly, taken up in a therapy group and not paraded with dogmatic pride for all of TV-dom to see. Father Bosco, I am not one who believes that clergy should be celibate. Or swing from chandeliers with consenting... Oh, wait, let me rephrase. Father Bosco, I am one who believes that clergy should be celibate or swing from chandeliers with consenting adults as they see fit. You, I surmise, have chosen a celibate path of your own volition. That does not mean you have any remote or imaginary authority to mandate that path for all women. I suppose you will be providing a big shoe or a big stake if women wish to choose otherwise. Okay, in your defense, maybe you are just missing the big picture here. Women, like women and over half the population. Women of all double X individual on the face of the planet. Do you get how small you really are, Facebook? This is not a fight about religious rights. This is not a fight about the government taking control of American lives. This is a fight about misogyny. Father Bosco and company, you lost that fight, so move on. Hugs and yes, blessings from Balbo Biggins. Well, I hope you enjoy that. Balbo Biggins will be sending her columns to me on a somewhat regular basis, and I'm happy to share them with listeners. Well, I am going to take a break here and play a little bit of music. I am going to try to see if I can connect with Emmanuel on one of my other phones here. So if you will stay tuned, I am going to go ahead and play the entirety of Sabbath's Night, that wonderful song by Witches Mark that I just gave you a little tease of at the start of the show. So let's do that for the next 5 minutes while I try to track down my second guest. Mm-hmm. I think we might have our second guest now with us. Let me go ahead and check and see if that's Emmanuel.
Indeed it is. It's Emmanuel.
Oh, hi. Welcome. I was so glad I was able to find you.
Ah, well, you know, men always have excuses, but it shouldn't excuse us, right?
Okay. Well, I just want to say it's my pleasure to have on Voices of the Sacred Feminine an award-winning documentary filmmaker, a true Renaissance man and gentleman by the name of Emmanuel Atie, who I so enjoyed meeting at Olindar in Malibu, which is the home of Carla and Ray McCloskey, which in itself is surely a womb of Sophia. Many of us gathered in this home temple to meet Emmanuel with great excitement because he was screening the trailer to the film he's made called Femme, which is in post-production now. So let me set the tone a bit for the film. Here's the intro, listeners, so you can kind of see where Emmanuel is going with this film, something that we've all been long awaiting. He says, "Women used to rule the world. In ancient times, it was believed that Earth had been created by a goddess, and Mother Earth and embodied that spirituality. What was true about it, and what became myth? With the birth of the three main monotheistic religions, man pushed the woman outside of the temples and declared himself a living god. So what happened truly, and what is the role played by women in today's society? What defines a woman today? As all human beings, women are faced with essential questions they need to answer in order to find a meaning to their existence. In this documentary, Femme, Emmanuel explores the spirit and beautiful mind of woman and how women see the world. Femme looks at the physical presence of women and how, on an energy level, they are so important and complementary to men. Femme will redefine the role played by women to save our world. It will also reestablish a new and fresh approach for a better relationship between men and women. Without women, feminine energy, life just cannot be. So let's be clear about it. Let's embrace it and make one with women." That's wonderful, Emmanuel.
Oh, thank you. Well, after your beautiful speech of my photo, I don't have much to say, and actually probably better because with my accent, I'm always afraid people lose what I mean in translation sometimes.
Oh, no, you do just fine. So let me say bonsoir, and I'm so glad you were able to make it. I was beginning to get worried there for a minute, but I know you're probably so engrossed. The film is in post-production now, right?
Yes. Actually, I was with another woman, so you will excuse me, Karen. That's what I always say to my wife. But at least I was with another woman who is in the movie as well. Her name is Marilyn Tam, and she's a very inspirational Chinese woman who's going to join forces as well with us, like you did. So, yeah, it's been fascinating because especially, you know, let me say as a man, we are clueless about women. We might be born from a woman. We might live with women. But because it's still sadly such a 99% man world, we don't really comprehend the feminine, nor could we, because on top of that, whatever trace of the feminine is in us, in terms of energy, in terms of spirituality, it's castrated by indeed all this ultra-macho, patriarchal, dominant, killing system.
Yeah, well,
that,
you know,
that are indeed in religion, politics, and economics. So for me, it was, as a man, such a discovery to embrace that, to embrace my femininity, feminine side within, and really appreciate women and understand how capital they are for the balance of nature and life.
Well, you know, and I thank you for saying that. But I have to ask you, I mean, I'm sure you've probably been following the news the last few weeks. Have you ever heard it so bad here in the United States for women, with these crazy Republicans not, you know, wanting to take away contraception, for heaven's sake? I mean, how far back?
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But it's a sign that we have lost all common senses as a humanity. I mean, how can you tell a woman what to do with her own body? This is ridiculous. It shouldn't even be a debate. Like,
well,
we can debate about anything else, but your freedom, your choice, I'm sorry, you're in charge of yourself, and especially no man should tell a woman what to do with her life. I mean, it's not written in any scripture. It's written nowhere. So why do you want to make it a law? It's absurd. It's fascism.
Well, let me ask you. You're from France. What do the people in Europe say about this craziness?
Well, believe me, sadly, it's everywhere. You know, it's not only in the U.S. You know, in France, the debate is sensitive as well. You've got sadly some people who still want to control women, and they are using usually the religious argument. And again, I tell them, but wait again, it's never written in any scripture that a woman is under you and should be your slave. But no, actually, it's the idea that here it's bad and Europe is better. I don't think, you know, and actually it's interesting because I, for this movie, I really traveled the entire world. And I really sadly see that the condition of women are from bad to worse, from bad to worse. So it's bad in most of the Western world, and it's worse everywhere else. I mean, and let's be clear. I mean, we've made progresses. But, you know, you can vote and you can have a bank account, and that's just recent. Even in France, when I was born in 67, my mother couldn't have her own bank account. She couldn't make any decision without my dad. Even to go vote, my dad had to be there, you know, looking over her shadow, shoulder, and almost incite her who to vote for. So it's recent that in the Western world, women have a little bit of rights and not enough. And then the rest of the world, it's complete craziness, nonsense, you know, it's darkness, it's, the dark ages.
Emmanuel, I did not know it was like that over in France. I mean, I got the impression,
it's a little bit better than that, but it's deep down, it's still, let's say that here it's kind of a 50-50 debate, sadly. Over there, maybe, indeed, it's only a minority, 20-25% who really think women should be put in a cage and stay in a cage. But it's sadly, it's still a significant number of guys.
Yeah.
Who obviously force also women by dominating them mentally and raping them mentally to believe, oh no, it's fine. Yeah, I should stay home. I should wear something to cover my entire body, you know, nonsense, you know. Indeed, I don't have a right to say if I want to have a baby or not. I mean, we have lost our common sense, and I think that's something we should teach at school. I mean, we are taking a lot of courses at school, but a course in common sense, that would be welcome, I think.
Well, but I want to get to the talk, start mm-hmm. talking about the film. But one last question
sure.
about the how things are over in Europe. That 25% over in Europe, and I mean, I know that's a rough figure you're throwing out.
Yes.
But is it what's behind it? Is it economics? Is it religion?
Religion. And again, it's not understanding religion, because again, I'm somebody who is not for nor against religion. I think religion is an interesting blueprint to start in life and understand as a basis to give you ideas and a little bit of inspiration. But then you have to try to understand what was written at that time. And again, it's never written nowhere that a woman is less than a man. That's
absolutely
not true, you know. And so it's really people who don't understand their religion and who let themselves being manipulated by imams, priests, rabbis who really put in their head that, no, again, you're a man and you're the representative of God and your women are here to serve you. And that's, again, it's nowhere written. So why don't you guys go back and really read your books and just move away from all these people who try to manipulate you and brainwash you? It's not written. So.
Well, you know, Emmanuel, I suspect that they really know better, but they got a good thing going on, and you know, they
well,
figure
that
let's
as well.
Let's just stick to the story, you know. But okay, so let's talk about femme. You know, I think of me and probably a lot of women I know who have been, you know, wishing and praying for something like this to be out there in the world, to educate and dispel misinformation. I think we probably all thought, you know what, if anybody was going to do it, it was going to be a woman. So But no, it's you. You know, you're a wonderful Frenchman.
Your typical macho French pig. Yes, indeed.
No, you are not like that at all.
Well, I'm
not
a civilized
like
one. I've evolved after free marriage and complex relationship. I've evolved. You know, I'm far away from being a real man, but I'm getting there little by little. But yeah, but I think it's a point, and again, the point of this movie is not to say, hey, let's throw away patriarchy and replace it by matriarchy. No,
no.
It's together, men and women, as it was in the past a long, long time ago, you know, and it's actually archaeologically, we kind of know it's roughly minus 10,000 years before Jesus Christ that the point started with all the invasions of Indo-European, and indeed, little by little, this monotheistic patriarchal religion being put in place. But before that, there were really no trace of genocide. There were no trace of society that were not governed together by women and men in equality. And sure, you had a few little matriarchal tribe there and there, but it was the minority. Mainly the entire world was working together as one humanity. And
yeah, egalitarian.
That life is created by a man and a woman. You know, so why would a woman be less or a man be less than its partner?
Well, you know, these monotheistic religions are really good at turning nature on its head and,
uh-huh.
you know, not listening to those lessons that nature tries to teach us.
Absolutely.
But how did you first come to this? You know, what inspired you to do the film?
Yeah, well, we have to go back a little bit in time. Six and a half years ago, my son was born, and I thought, hey, I should inquire about the planet. I'm a very concerned individual. I feel we are living in tough time, and and I think at least most of the 7 billion people will agree on me that it's really tough for everyone, except that famous one person. So, you know, I was very concerned. So I went around the world and I did that first documentary, which is about the notion of God and peace called The Invocation, which is coming out in the U.S. in June or July. And it was done with Deepak Chopra, the Dalai Lama, but also plenty of women like Karen Armstrong. And so therefore I realized, wow, all these women are giving me so much more information and viable solution to indeed make it better, find some viable, sustainable ideas and cure for poverty and misery and war. So I thought, well, really, the solution seemed to lay much more in the feminine than in the masculine. The masculine is just recycling its own stupidity. So that's really what kind of triggered it. It's me by traveling around the world and meeting all these women from India to Japan to South Africa to Latin America, Europe and America, and realizing, you know, that has never been done, and especially, indeed, as you said, by a man, a real objective exploration of that feminine and understand how it's so complementary and so necessary for the balance, as you said, of nature. In nature, everything is balanced between the feminine and the masculine. So why don't we do that in our society? Because indeed, we had let this ultra-patriarchal system dominate us and really totally brainwash us with this idea that the world and existence and God is a dude. It's not.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here. So let me ask
But what's interesting is, yes, I'm preaching to the choir, but at the same time, sadly, there are too many women who don't really, that they are afraid to listening to the inner voice and say, yes, that's right, I should fight for my rights of equality and progress and evolution. So the movie is for them to empower these silent women, especially in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia. And also, it's to trigger men's brain, because men are, as we know, they are good deep down. It's just that they've been programmed to kill. But they are not born a killer. Nobody is born evil. I don't believe in evil. I believe in somebody getting lost. And the metaphor of Jesus Christ being tempted by Satan, it's exactly like that. It's that indeed, it's very easy in life to get lost and to depress and fall from grace and lose your faith within, your trust, because faith is a word that means fidere in Latin, which means trust, the trust in yourself, in life. And that's very easy, especially in this time. So I understand why people say, oh, it's so hard for men. Yeah, because we have put all this illusion of dominance and Superman complex on them. So they just don't know to handle it when really they realize that they are as powerful or powerless than anybody else. So don't be afraid. Don't be frustrated. You're a good man deep down, but don't be scared to reach out and say, I love you. You know, we don't say this word enough. We always say the F-U-C-K, Y-O-U, you know. Let's
right.
say I love you much more and see how it works.
Well, I'm curious, as you went around the world, you were obviously meeting a lot of powerful women, but did you run into any men that, sort of thought you were crazy for doing this?
Yeah, every single day. I mean, even to this day where I'm trying to get distribution for this movie, and right now I know it's pointless because sadly the distribution world is controlled 99% by these men who have chosen not to be unitive and not to be loving, and they just want to tell you what to put out. And so for them, it's a threat when another guy said, no, we're all equal. We all need each other. There isn't a chosen people. There isn't a chosen sex. There isn't a chosen religion. So, yes, I mean, I've got constantly men in my way because we always talk about the abuse from men over women, but we don't talk about the abuse of men over men because men are scared to say, oh, I've been abused, I've been raped. I'm sorry, I'm being mentally raped every day by men, and that's enough. And really, that's enough because I know that these men are good deep down. It's just that they don't know better. They were told they have to dominate, they have to conquer, they have to kill me. No, you don't, because if you kill me, you kill a potential customer. So it's a stupid game. It's the only business plan that says, oh, let's kill all our customers. I mean, it makes no sense. It's counter-logic and it's counterproductive and it's counter-life. So,
well,
you're very
courageous for saying that.
Thank you for
sharing that.
My pleasure.
Well, what is it? We could talk about some of the women and men you've interviewed for Femme, but besides that, I'm wondering what do you want listeners to know about the movie? I mean,
I want to know that it's really a movie about we. You know, I think we have to again think that the me, myself, and I is an idea that doesn't work anymore, and nor do I think it ever worked. But it put us in the situation we are. So all these movies are really to incite us to have faith in we the people, we the humanity, we the planet. And that's why I'm making these movies, to give back that natural faith, that natural common sense that we all have deep inside of us. And that impulse to dare to say I love you instead of taking the easy way and throwing out people and pushing them away and looking at them like, oof, I'm this superior being and they're just a bunch of idiots. No, there are only 7 billion geniuses on this planet. And the only way to solve cancer and AIDS and war and pandemic, it's to work together because everybody has a clue, has a solution. And you can talk to anyone, whether they're somebody driving a taxi cab or a CEO or sweeping the floor or cook, they are all brilliant human beings. You just need to stop and listen to them. And that's a feminine, really, thing, that characteristic that women do much better than us, men. Again, because we were trained to just go, 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 do, 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 kill, kill, kill. We don't listen anymore. We don't stop. We don't think. We
right,
just act.
Right.
That's it. And then we look at our act and we say, oops, I should have thought. Yes. And women, on the contrary, you know, they think. Sometimes, sadly, it's the opposite. Maybe they think too much, so they have to go to the doing a little more. It's balance. It's complementarity. It's a dance, you know. It's the I think, therefore I am, therefore I do. So we have to complete the sentences, and that's what I'm trying to do with this movie. I'm trying to incite people to be peace in action, not only in talks. You know,
right.
the past century was the century of the thinking and the being. Great. It's a process that's necessary. Now we are in urgent time. You know, there are pandemics, there is natural catastrophes, financial crashes. So we are in the century of action. So we have to wake up, stand up, unite, and act and do.
There you go. And start thinking more about the we than the I.
Absolutely. Because, again, the we include the I, but sadly, rarely the I think about the we.
So tell me some of the names of the people we would probably recognize that or we'll see in the film.
Well, first, my partner is Sharon Stone, with whom I'm producing all these movies. So she was graceful to tolerate my madness and guide my madness and structure it. And because, you know, I'm very passionate, as you can hear and feel. So Sharon Stone is in it. We've got, obviously, the Jean Huston, Jean Shinoba Bolen, Gloria Steinem, Barbara Maxorbat, Karen Tate. You know, we have really amazing people. We have Nobel Peace Prize laureates such as Shirin Ebadi from Iran, Mairead Maguire from Ireland, Judy Williams from England. I'm talking with Lima Jibowi, who just got the Nobel Peace Prize, from Liberia. So really, it's going to be a rich view and exploration of that notion of the feminine, and again, to empower women to keep doing what they are doing and to ask, please, men, wake up, you know, wake up and dare to love.
Work
to
with us.
Surrender to the love. Surrender to the love that your women are telling you every day. Because if you listen to them, that's all they are saying. They are not saying, bye-bye, get out, you know, die. They are saying, I love you. Please listen to me. So I'm begging you, please
work
listen
with us.
To your women. Well, listen to your feminine within, and it comes naturally.
Absolutely. So how close are you to finishing the film now?
Well, now we are, I would say, 80% done. We are planning one more trip, because these movies are really shot around the world to make you feel the planet, to make you feel the oneness. So something, an invocation for the femme, I want it to be a window of the feminine everywhere. So we just came back from India. Well, I did a few star names to give a little bit of commercial cachet to the movie and accessibility. And then we are planning a trip in China in April. When we are back, we're going to finish the editing between May and June, July. I'm negotiating with a famous actor to be the narrator, like I got Sharon Stone to narrate the first movie. I want a big-name actor to do the narration of that one, and also to show the partnership between, the masculine and the feminine. And so I hope we are totally done over the summer. And then the approach to release it is going to be different. With Invocation, I did a typical video, TV, and all that. And it was a nightmare because it wasn't done by passionate people. It was handled by people who didn't care. So for this one, I'm going to choose to first go to female and children-driven website, give them the movie for streaming, and see how it works. But I think that's a much better way to reach out to people, to also obviously hopefully get a little bit of money back so I can keep doing more of this type of educative documentaries, humanitarian-driven documentaries. And that's the idea. So complete the movie the summer, release hopefully by the fall. And I think
we are pretty much there.
The still little bump is raising this last $60,000 that I need to pay for all the trip and the editing and the stock footage. And believe me, it's hard. You know, I always put my own money, and then, you know, I beg friends and people to please join in and invest in the movie.
So will this be a movie that will actually be at the movie theaters, or will it be a more limited release?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, movie theaters today are not the first place where people go for this type of inspirational documentaries. They usually go online, or the New Age video store and so on, or even iTunes or Amazon. So I think in terms of the theatrical screening, what I will do with FAM is definitely go to film festival. We did that with Invocation. It was a great exposure. We went to 20 film festivals around the world, got 10 awards. So for FAM, I'm going to do that, and that will help with the promotion. Then now to have a real platform release or per limited city release, I'm not sure. It's a lot of money. It's really hard to ask people, and nor do I think it's fair to ask people to go and spend $10. I'm one of these, again, I'm going to make a lot of enemies tonight. But think about it. The reason why the movie industry is losing money is because they are greedy. It's because they are still asking you to spend anywhere from $12 to $20 to go see a movie. When really it's not justified. This is a mass market. You know, do you pay $12 to $20 for a McDonald's? No, you don't. Okay, or for an ice cream, for a coffee. A movie is the same. You know, you're spending an hour and a half. That's it. So it's a lot of money, especially for a family of four, and by the time you add the parking and the popcorn and so on. So, you know, for my movies, I want to make them accessible. And that's why also I want to go with the Internet, because it's easier to tell them, listen, I give you the movie for streaming, but only to the condition that you make it at a price between $1 to $5. And that's it. I want it to be seen by the mass majority. And that's the only way, up to $5. You know, especially with all these names, people think, hey, that's worth my risk.
Well, when it's ready, you know, maybe we can arrange to have you screen it at the Goddess Temple down in Orange County.
Yes, and there will be a lot of that time. Yes, that I love because, as you said, it's a communion. The only good thing about going to the movies is that it's a communion of us getting together. So, yes, I want to go to temple, to yoga centers, to spiritual retreats, you know, do specific screening where again we make it accessible. We don't charge $10, but hopefully we charge $5, and people come and they communicate and they change and they realize their oneness. Absolutely.
Well, I think women will come in droves to watch this, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart for putting your time and your money and your energy into this, because you know we just so need this. We need this for the world, not just for women.
Yeah, and I thank you for making me alive, you know, because again, guys, you know, without women, hey, where will we be? Ask yourself the question. You know, I leave you with that to ponder. You know, so you don't want your women, you treat them like lesser than you, but hey, without them, what are you? Nothing.
Absolutely.
You're totally dust. You don't even exist.
So now, I know you have a trailer that's that people can actually look at.
Yes.
How would my listeners find that to look at it, Emmanuel?
Well, the easiest way is to go on my website, and it's www.wonderland, E-N-T, for entertainment, group, GROUP.com. So wonderlandantgroup.com. And right there, you get to our website where you have the trailer, a link to the trailer of Invocation, the one we just finished and was been released already. We've got the promo of FAM, and you can even reach me through the email address on the website. And if not, you can also Google me, Emmanuel, E-T-I-T-I-E-R. And I'm very easy to find, and all the information is on Google. So,
and people can make donations to you if I
absolutely. If you feel like it's your call to invest anything, please, you know, reach out. I will make a good use of your money. Absolutely.
Okay. And just quickly about Invocation, you said that's going to be out soon. That we can see
yes,
that as well.
Yes. Yes. I was again arguing with a bunch of guys. You know, we're on top of that, put on the line a lot of their own money. So it's like that's or sometimes again, guys have lost total common sense. The movie Invocation with Deepak Chopra, the Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, Sharon Stone, and on and on and on and on is finished for the last year and a half, and we still don't have not even a release on iTunes and Amazon and all that. And I say, guys, how is it? Well, it's because they are greedy. They want millions. And I say, well, okay, after a year and a half, you're not going to get it, so let's be smart. And today I thought we would conclude again, you know, a very creative deal to put it out. And we were unable because they wanted more and more and more. And, you know, when it's dead, it's dead. So you have to let it go. That's a problem. Guys never want to let it go, even when it's dead.
So
it seems like that worst-case scenario, it will go out in the U.S. because, again, it's been released all over Latin America, in Australia, in Spain, Scandinavia, so big part of Europe. And my only drama is the U.S. and France, which is very ironic. I love the U.S. I live here for 25 years. I'm French, and my two countries of love and adoption are booing the movie. So it's really funny. Well, they are not these countries are not bringing the movie because we played in so many film festivals, and that's where we got the most awards. So I know the people want the movie, but the distributor, who are again guys who think that somewhat the movie is not good enough because, again, it's talking about love and it's not talking about war, and somewhat the illusion that war is better than peace. And again, no, it doesn't. War killed your customer, so war is stupid. It's the worst business plan you can have in your mind. So worst-case scenario, yes, it will be released in June. At least I got the word that worst-case scenario, this greedy guy would put it out digitally. So,
okay.
So it will be out, you know. Already we've done like so many screenings. And again, if you like what you see on the website, contact me and we'll do some private screening. Absolutely, so that
okay.
You know, I can do it.
All right. Well, before we say goodnight, is there anything else you'd like to say to listeners?
Wake up, stand up, unite, be peace in action. You are a genius. You are a beautiful soul. I love you.
And I love you, Emmanuel. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
I love you too, Karen. Have a great evening, and thank you so much for the opportunity and for being part of FEM.
Oh, it's my honor. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, my dear. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, isn't he fun? And you will most definitely enjoy seeing the film Invocation. I saw some snippets of that at Olander the same night we saw the trailer for FEM. And if you couldn't quite understand what Emmanuel said, you can go to Wonderland Ent Group, Wonderland, ENTGROUP.com, and you can click on the links there, and you can find out more about the two movies and sort of get some little teasers just to give you a sense of what he's doing. And these are really very high-quality, films, documentaries. These are not cheaply done. They're lovely. Well, it's almost time for me to say goodnight. I want to make sure you know that next week we will actually have two shows. We're going to have a special show on Monday, the 27th, to make up for a show I missed earlier in the month when I was away on vacation. On the 27th, this Monday, I will have Jeanette Clancy on the show, and our topic is going to be Christian language that perpetuates sex abuse and male domination. And after Jeanette, we're going to have Jan Aldridge Clanton talking about her new book, The Changing Church, Stories of Liberating Ministers. Both women I've had on the show before, wonderful, doing wonderful work out there. I'm glad that they will be back again talking about these new subjects. And then on Thursday of next week, I will be doing the ritual on the radio, so tune in for that. Well, I'd like to close the show tonight with a power prayer for the priestess right now. That's what it's called, and it's by Ava, who is the foundress of the Goddess Temple in Orange County. And this is how it goes. Again, it's called the power prayer for the priestess right now by Ava. Walking through my day in protection, peace, and power, sleeping through the night, guardian angels every hour. Blessing those who suffer, may they rest in sacred peace. From my realm and from my life do I peacefully release. All is safe and sound in my world and in my heart. I am grateful now for every teaching, every part. In the Aluna Ped, two lionesses on either side of me, silent, huge, fierce, and strong, mean spirits now must flee. My guardian dogs are loyal, they are good and they are true, protecting all I have, all I am, and all I do. Thank you, guides and goddesses who surround us with your love. Aphrodite, you are here with your bird of peace, the dove. Hecate, your wisdom torch leads us at every turn. Sekhmet, in your fire, every hatred must soon burn. Skathech protects only the wise and not the cruel. Defy her and do evil, and she'll put you through her school. Diana, queen of sisters, magical and old, this sisterhood is strong, the true story will be told. Bridget, take your anvil, Bridget, take your tongs, toss this rubbish in your fire, hammer lies and wrongs. Kali, guard our temple. Kartika, raised on high. We are in your keeping. You work it out by and by. Kuan Yin, calm the storm with compassion pure and strong. To goodness, love, and beauty must temple priestesses belong. Isis, we do call upon you, Queen of Heaven and our friend. Gather all the far-flung pieces in wholeness now these mend. Thank you, source of all, as we focus on the good. We hold our loving center as the goddess priestess should. If we stand with the goddess, who can stand against us long? Priestess, walk in dignity, in goodness are we strong. Magic works on our behalf right now in worlds unseen. Let us all be at peace today. Let us all walk as queen. So thank you, Ava, for writing that, and I just want to say happy birthday, and thank you for all you do. You know, those of us who only dreamed of having a goddess temple, well, you made it happen, and I believe you've kept that temple open down in Orange County for 7 or 8 years. You know, we appreciate you and all the priestesses there who have dedicated their time, not just today, but over the years. So, listeners, I guess that will be all for tonight. I have about 10 minutes left to stream, so I think what I'll do is go ahead and play the song Sabbath's Night so you can hear it from beginning to end. And I hope you will tune in with me on Monday of next week and on Thursday. Please tell your friends about the show. Don't forget our Sacred Sundays, in North Hollywood. If you'd like to attend, please go to my website and check out my books, KarenTate.com. Download the free meditations there. And finally, this show is not free for me to do. I actually pay to bring you these guests. So that their wisdom and their insight can become part of the consciousness out there, so that we can teach, so that we can have an on-air community of like mind. So if you would like to contribute to the show, I am happy to accept any small donation because it all adds up. You know, if we all stand together, even a dollar makes a difference if 100 people send a dollar. So if you would like to contribute to the show, you can go to my website at KarenTate.com, go to the Goddess Store page, scroll all the way down to the bottom. You'll see some PayPal buttons, and you can click one of those buttons and donate any amount you like to help me keep the show on the air. Or you can just email me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com, and I will happily tell you where you can send a check. All right, listeners, well, my blessing to you until next time is may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings, and enjoy the music as we close the show. It's Sabbath's Night by Witch's Mark. Kicking, whining, cover up for me.
desire me.